decade ago, Americans were glued to their TV screens watching in fascinated horror as the city of New Orleans disappeared under 15 feet of muddy water. The levees designed to protect the city from the Mississippi River suffered massive breaches, leaving thousands to flee in panic or face possible death by drowning in their homes. Almost 1,000 lost their lives, more than half of them elderly. The city's housing stock was devastated. Half the population disappeared, many forever. Our next guest tells about those who stayed to rebuild their city, the many volunteers who defied dysfunction and corruption. Journalist and urban critic Roberta Brandes-Gratz on what worked and what didn't in New Orleans after Katrina. She joins us on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. How do you rebuild a city once it's been drowned? How do you rebuild a city when half its population has left town? How do you rebuild a waterlogged infrastructure and thousands of homes submerged for weeks? Our next guest says the answer is perseverance, unlimited sweat, and a willingness to fight through red tape to preserve what's been best about a city whose history and culture give it a unique place in the American constellation. The city, of course, is New Orleans. On August 29, 2005, Hurricane Katrina struck, leaving a trail of destruction, death, and despair and rage. At one point, more than 80% of the city was underwater, and almost 1,000 residents, mostly elderly, perished when local, state, and federal agencies were unable or unwilling to save them. Thousands more were rescued by a flotilla of small boats piloted by citizens from every walk of life who defied official orders to stay at home and risked their lives to pluck stranded residents from rooftops. Urban critic, journalist, and author Roberta Brandes-Gratz says it's that community spirit that's helping New Orleans recover from the worst beating suffered by an American city since the San Francisco earthquake and fire of 1906. In addition to 130,000 homes damaged or destroyed, New Orleans lost half its population, much of its infrastructure, and many of its institutions. Roberta Gratz describes the battles of those who stayed on and those who returned to help rebuild the patchwork quilt of communities, cultures, and architecture that make New Orleans unique among American cities. She shows how residents and community groups from the poverty-stricken Lower Ninth Ward to the renowned French Quarter to the Garden District took matters into their own hands. Community preservationists lost as many battles as they won, including the destruction of some of the best public housing in the country, as well as the replacement of the city's famed charity hospital with a mega center that destroyed entire neighborhoods. It's a remarkable tale by a writer who not only knows her subject, but cares about it. Roberta Brandes-Gratz published four previous books, including The Battle for Gotham, New York and the Shadow of Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and The Nation. And the new book is We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. It's available from Nation Books. Roberta Brandes-Gratz, welcome to the Midday Show here on WYPR in Baltimore.
Well, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. And I think our listeners probably need some refresher on what happened with Katrina. I mean, most of us remember these frightening, I would say infuriating and embarrassing images of New Orleans residents suffering and far too often dying in the aftermath of Katrina, while it seemed like government at every level was incapable of dealing with the immediate disaster. So I didn't want to go over all that ground again, but I think I'd like to ask you to, you know, sort of set the scene for our listeners whose memories might need some refreshing.
Well, first, I think it's very important to understand that it was not the hurricane that caused the disaster. It was the failure of the levees built by the Corps of Engineers. 53 places along the levees in the city breached. The hurricane was passed. The sun was out. People were rejoicing that they had beat the bullet. And the next thing they knew, water was coming up, 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 up. And that was because the levees broke. So this is not a natural, this was not a natural disaster. This was a man-made disaster. Once you understand that, then everything is almost downhill from there. 80% of the city was flooded, no doubt. The water receded in some neighborhoods faster than others. But the inequity started with the choice of neighborhoods that were where people were allowed back. For example, the Lower Ninth Ward was the last neighborhood where homeowners were allowed to come back and even look at the damage of their homes, open windows, bring insurance agents, whatever. So it started out badly in the aftermath, and then you immediately had a business and civic leadership buoyed by lots of experts questioning whether the city ever could come back, whether parts of the neighborhood of the city should, whether there are neighborhoods that should be bulldozed and turned into parks. And then you had suggestions by the experts, just the kind of things that kill cities. Let's have a moratorium on permits. Let's make neighborhoods prove themselves, give them 4 months to see how many people would come back, whether the neighborhood would be considered viable by the city leadership. All these kind of ridiculous mechanisms were suggested all from the top, from not from the people who had suffered the consequences, but from outside and even inside experts. The good news was that the incompetent mayor, Ray Nagin, did nothing. So none of those suggestions took root. A planning process was put in place that went through several false stops. So while all the officials and the experts were trying to figure it all out, people took it into their own hands and just forged ahead. They either individually came back, cleaned out their houses, did whatever they could, even coming temporarily, commuting from jobs they found elsewhere, or not coming at all. And groups, not-for-profit groups, formed like had never happened in the city before. Neighborhood by neighborhood, groups formed to help each other, to help homeowners go through the bureaucracy of the road home process to see what kind of money they could get, to go through the insurance process. A lot of these people you're talking about had no familiarity with dealing with a bureaucracy. It was impenetrable for many. And in the private company that was contracted to manage the road home money, remember, this was not government, this was a contractor. Most of these things were private contractors, not government bureaucrats. They kept losing files, losing people. It was horrendous. Mm. So there was a lot of on-the-ground help needed. And then various organizations were started and outside funding came in so that you had rebuilding efforts, everything from small, you know, two, three houses to 100 or 200 houses in either the Make It Right program or the Coming Home Home Again program, the Len Riggio Foundation and the Brad Pitt Foundations and church groups. So what you really had was letting the market dictate what happened, not government. And it's kind of an irony because this was a natural process of rebuilding. You then had major problems, challenges with the infrastructure. But then you had Entergy filing for bankruptcy in order to get enormous sums of money to continue the rebuilding of the infrastructure so that electricity could reach back into the neighborhoods. You had a sewage and water system already dated that needed big infusions of government support to get rebuilt. So you did have some major funding appropriately for rebuilding the infrastructure. But in the meantime, people went about and rebuilt house by house, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. And that's the success, qualified as it must be, but that's the success you see today.
All right. So you covered a lot of the waterfront there for us, and I need to go back and ask you some specific things. You mentioned Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans at the time. He just started serving a 10-year federal sentence for, what do we have here, bribery, conspiracy, money laundering, much of which occurred in Katrina's aftermath. So you in particular fault him. Let's just talk a little bit more about how Ray Nagin contributed to this man-made disaster. You said he did nothing, basically.
Right. Well, that, you know, people sort of raise their eyebrows and say, oh, the mayor did nothing. And I say, that's the good news. The good news, he did nothing, because people then rallied to do it themselves. Can you imagine if they had actually put a 4-month moratorium place for building permits so that people wouldn't have been allowed to rebuild their homes? Can you imagine if a neighborhood had 4 months to prove that enough people were coming back in order to be defined as viable? Would you rebuild your house in a neighborhood that you wouldn't know in advance had a future? Mm-hmm. I mean, these were suggestions by the experts pushing Nagin to do these things, and he just did nothing, which was the good news.
Right. I see why you say that's the good news. Yeah. Now, when we get to the federal side, Michael Brown was the head of FEMA at the time. You set up a lot of heroes and villains in this book, but the top of the bad actor list is Michael Brown. So let's talk about his role in this as head of the Federal Disaster Agency. Why is he near the top of your list on the bad side?
Well, he's not alone. They were all in cahoots. But the FEMA contracts, which I go into in as much detail as I could find in the book, all went to politically connected mega organizations and corporations, some of the same people that rebuilt Iraq. So this was not money going to New Orleans. This was money going to a private contractor, not even in Louisiana, let's take the example of the blue tarp, which was the familiar plastic covering of all the roofs to keep the rain out.
Disaster capitalism.
Here we go. Mm-hmm. So $175 a square the contract was for. Subcontracted three times before it got to the poor guy on the ground who put the square up for $7 a square. Now, where did all that money go? It did not go to New Orleans. It went to contractors out of the city, mostly out of the state. I make a point in the book, and nobody can challenge this because nobody really knows. I would say that if you take out from the billions spent on the recovery, if you take out what was spent on the rebuilding of the levees, which was about $14 billion, and if you take out the $1.1 and counting billion for this unnecessary new hospital, and you just add the rest of it, I would say maybe 20% of that hit the ground in New Orleans. The rest went all over the country to contracts through the state, to a lot of banks, because road home money, if you were qualified, say for $100,000, the money went through your bank where you had a mortgage. The mortgage was then paid off. So if you had a $60,000 mortgage on your $100,000 house, $60,000 immediately deducted by the banks, you're left with $40,000 for a house that maybe will cost $250,000 to build. Now, you needed some pretty, hefty savings to supplement that, assuming maybe even if you got some insurance. So the point is, the money did not go on the ground. A lot of the money that came in to help people rebuild came in through donations, volunteers. The most wonderful part of watching this whole process was to see people come from all across America to help side by side with local people to rebuild their neighborhoods, whether it was cleaning up the landscape, cleaning up debris, or actually building houses. It was the real barn-raising instinct of the American people, and it really warms the heart when you see it in its best application. That's where all the help really came. Sure, some money trickled down, but it was minuscule in comparison to the money that went out and up.
We'll talk some more about this when we get back, especially the volunteer part, the grassroots part of this story of New Orleans in the wake of Katrina with Roberta Brandes-Gratz. Her book is We're Still Here, You Bastards, and we're going to tell you about that title when we get back as well. A short break here on the Midday Show. We'll be right back. Dan Rodericks here on the Midday Show, speaking with Roberta Brandes-Gratz, an expert on urban communities and architecture and author of a really illuminating book, a new book on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina that takes its title from a sign scrawled on a building down in New Orleans. Could you tell us a little bit about We're Still Here, You Bastards?
Well, one Roberta. Of the kind of interesting things after Katrina was, there was no communication. The phones were down. There was nothing. So people had the most creative ways of communicating, and graffiti was the way. We're Still Here, You Bastards was on the side of a building, and that was in response to the people who said, there's nothing left. There shouldn't be. Should we rebuild it all, and should we tear down, and all that kind of stuff? There was a spirit, and it was expressed through graffiti, and this was one of them. There was another one that was a favorite. All the refrigerators had to be put out on the sidewalk. No one would dare open them because after weeks, you can imagine the stink. Mm-hmm. So there was one pair out on the sidewalk, and it said, "Our Twin Towers." it just expressed how people felt, and this made such an impression on me that this title seemed so appropriate because that's the way they feel.
The book is published by Nation Books. Roberta, I want to ask you about the Lower Ninth Ward. I want to go there because I think this is a good story to talk about for so many reasons, so many different aspects of what happened in the wake of Katrina. This is the worst flooding occurred in the Lower Ninth Ward, home to, you would say, most of the city's poor African Americans. What happened there, it's kind of fascinating. So I think we should talk about this. There were some people who thought that it just should not return. People should not return to that area, right? Wasn't that part of the discussion about the Lower Ninth Ward?
Sure. The people who felt that, of course, never lived in the city or lived somewhere on the other side of town. That was not a feeling that they either consulted or heard from the people themselves. Let me back up for a minute and say that a lot of the issues that I deal with in this book are applicable in many variations to cities across the country. The issues are about community involvement, the expression of people, transparency, how government functions, and who are the experts? Are the experts the ones who you know, plan cities like and deal with people and houses like chess pieces on a chessboard, moving them around at will? Or are they people on the ground who understand, particularly in a city like New Orleans, that people live in family clusters? That's why I use in the beginning of the book the metaphor of the live oak tree, with its deep roots that are all connected, and with a that hold the strength of the city is held together through those connected roots. So I use the Lower Ninth Ward as my first chapter because it's the most misunderstood of all the stories, but it was the one focused most by the TV cameras, because that's where one of the two or three areas that was most deeply flooded with people on rooftops and things like that. So the Lower Ninth, number one, is lower, not in feet. It is not the lowest point in the city. It is lower because the Ninth Ward was bisected years ago by the Industrial Canal. So you now have the Upper Ninth Ward and the Lower Ninth Ward. It's a geographic term. That's number one. Number two, it was not the highest concentration of poverty. It had the highest home ownership rate in the city. 65% of the people own their homes. Now, how did this happen? It happened because so many of them, either themselves or their fathers or their grandfathers, built the houses. They built them without mortgages. They built them with their own hands, and they passed down from one generation to the next. Many of these people lived in family clusters. If the poverty rate was high, it was often because there were elderly who were not employed or handicapped that couldn't be employed and unemployed. But you had a basic community of working class, low-income people. But some not so low income, which I point out in the book. So the Lower Ninth Ward is important in many ways, but it reflects the misunderstanding of the larger city. This is true in other cities. You have low income, primarily black communities that are heavily working class communities assumed by outsiders to be poverty and crime-stricken only. We have a way of disconnecting from our low-income neighborhoods in almost every city, so that when disaster strikes, we really don't know who we're dealing with.
You could be talking about Baltimore.
Yes, sir.
I think that's why you're saying this. But it describes New Orleans. It describes other situations.
It does describe Baltimore, and I've written about Baltimore in the past. I haven't been there in a number of years. But it's not just Baltimore. It's every city that has any kind of low-income, working-class population. The divide in our cities is beyond the point of easy understanding. And one of the good things that came after Katrina was that the people who had been left out of the process for so long rallied and demanded a voice and got a voice and got involved in the future planning of the city. And there was a new transparency and there was a new listening to the community. I question in the final chapter whether the old is returning. A lot of the old habits of backroom dealing in the city council and mistakes by the Planning Commission and, rulings from on top are reemerging. But the city electorate got involved in ways they didn't before, and some of that divide was overcome.
Do you conclude from your research that officials there, these experts, the people who, were thinking about all this from up top, decided that it would be okay if many black people did not return to the Lower Ninth Ward?
Absolutely.
Tell them maybe they shouldn't return, or how did that
absolutely
play out?
The figures and there's nothing definite, but there's an approximate 100,000 African Americans who have not returned to New Orleans. Most of them would be low income because they can't, the rentals have doubled since Katrina. They can't afford to come back, or they can't rebuild their home. And some people have relocated in places where they could get a job that was at a higher pay than the $7.25 hourly wage of New Orleans, on which a family with two jobs cannot survive, even on a check weekly check basis. So you have that that problem, and it was articulated kind of innocently and frankly by a number of the business elite in the very beginning. Said we can't have the same division in black and white and rich and poor that we had before. So, you know, let's keep them out. Well, the fact is you had the demolition of a couple of major public housing projects that would never have happened without Katrina, because they were emptied out. They were evacuated, even though there was little, if any, storm damage, and then nobody was allowed back in. So you had over 5,000 residents that were just displaced and can't come back for one reason or another.
Is that because the officials saw this as an opportunity to get rid of public housing, even though this public housing is not post-World War II, it's pre-World War II, right? This goes back to the Depression, right?
This goes back to the 1940s when the construction of red brick public housing was at a higher level than anything built today. And they could have been rehabbed, they could have been gutted, but they're two separate issues. What could have happened to the buildings themselves, and the sites could have been reimagined. You could have put streets in, you could have taken down a few, you could have added a few. That's the physical side of it. But the population side is that the replacement housing, the new federal programs are for the economically integrated. So you've got three levels of income residents. But the problem is, you do the math. If you got 1,000 units, you tear down 1,000, and you're operating on the misunderstanding that de-densification will improve things. It has shown not to make a difference in crime or anything else. In fact, it exacerbates crime in many ways. But if you remove 1,000 units, you rebuild, you build, say, 700 new ones, of which you're going to divide in three levels of income. And maybe 200 units will be public housing level. So you do the math. Where are those other 800 people? Mm-hmm. Okay, some of them get Section 8 vouchers. Well, we know that the Section 8 vouchers that are supposed to go to public qualified tenants with no place to be located in public housing take those vouchers and go get a residence in another neighborhood. Well, the reality is, and there have been some recent stories, that Section 8 does not work to improve the lives of anybody. It just they take that money and they go into neighborhoods where landlords will accept a Section 8 are usually the neighborhoods that are already on the cusp of blight.
With other people who have Section 8. And isn't that one of the problems with Section 8 is that landlords can discriminate?
They can discriminate, and they're not as caring about their upkeep of their property. And then things deteriorate, and they always blame the tenant. Not that some tenants are to blame, but they're not all to blame. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's just been about privatizing the public housing across the country and scattering people. And in fact, what it really does is it strains already marginal neighborhoods, which then become the next neighborhood targeted for demolition and rebuilding. And there we go with private development again.
Roberta Brandes-Gratz, our guest in this hour of midday. Her book is We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. I'm going to ask you this question. It seems like your book does a very good job of, I would say, dispelling the myth that private industry can do things better than government. The private sector is where you need to go if you want to get something done quickly and efficiently. But that's not the case. And government is – where government is at fault here, the private sector even more so. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think we try to do these things, whether it's government or the private sector. If you're going to do it in big doses, if you're going to give out contracts and gazillion dollars and you're dealing with corporations or businesses that you know aren't on the ground, the further away you get from the spending of the money, the worse it's going to be, whether it's government bureaucrats or private industry. But the real myth is that if we privatize, which we're doing all across the government, this has been a pattern for the last several decades, if privatizing is no answer. It's an expensive answer because it means there's a hefty profit margin. And the first corporation that handled Road Home, for example, and was thrown out, I think walked away with a $900 million profit. I mean, give me a break. When the profit is huge and the distance is great, it is disaster, whether it's government or private. But the myth that private is better than government is what needs to be dispelled.
And one last thing before our next break, Roberta, because you referenced the Live Oaks, and I was going to ask you about the Live Oaks of New Orleans. Quote, with their strong interconnected root systems, the city's white African-American and Creole of color families have gained strength from their habitation in well-defined neighborhoods over many generations. And this sort of fits with what you were saying about the Lower Ninth Ward, too. I mean, some people may hear that and say that sounds like, the old Southern argument for segregation, for the traditional patterns of segregation, that sense that people, just have to know their place. I don't think that's what you're saying, though.
Oh, not at all. In fact, I say of New Orleans, it's the most integrated, segregated city that I know of, because it is extraordinary how, and this has been a long pattern, even in uptown, in the richer sections of town, you had a pattern where the mansions were on the street, but sort of behind a lot of the big houses were the small cottages and shotgun cottages where the service people lived. Or you crossed St. Charles and you were in the hood, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There was great proximity, and there still is in many neighborhoods. However, I'm not a believer in this is something I've really been thinking about a lot lately, this whole idea that you can easily integrate a city is not something that there's a lot of effort put into it, but there's a lot of thoughtless effort put into it because people aren't looking to the areas where it has worked. And if you observe, and that's what all my writing is about, it's about observation, about what works and what doesn't. And if you look at the, if you observe the neighborhoods that are really integrated, it's a very interesting process to have happened, and it's not forced.
Roberta, we'll come back and talk some more. Roberta Brandes-Gratz, our author this hour, We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City, is published by Nation Books. A short break and some more questions for Roberta about the comeback of New Orleans in the 10 years since Katrina. And welcome back once again. Thanks for making midday part of your day here. We're speaking with Roberta Brandes-Gratz, author of a book called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. In this segment of the show, Roberta, we've got to talk about some of those people. Eric in Baltimore has a question for you, though. Eric, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Dan. Thank you. And thanks for just first I've heard of your book, Ms. Brandis Gratz. I hope I pronounced it correctly.
You did.
Question about the federal response. I distinctly recall that President Bush said nobody thought the levees would break, and then reading that his own administration had just conducted a study predicting exactly that outcome.
Right.
Is there any reason to think that that was not a lie?
Oh, no, it did happen. They had a whole simulated study, that I think it was the year before, and the president had been informed. So that's all, that's nonsense. It was expected. It was foretold. So to think that it wasn't expected, he just wasn't telling the truth.
Okay. Thank you for that. The community activists there, those who wanted to preserve buildings, wanted to do the right thing. The public housing projects were one example of that. Then this charity hospital, the fight over charity hospital. We ought to talk about how that played out.
Well, I think it's very important. There are two things about charity that are important. One is the larger issue that the best thing about New Orleans was it had at least a preservation mindset dating from the 1970s. So it has many neighborhoods that are historic neighborhoods, and there is at least a strong caring about its historic architecture. So there is a preservation mindset. And you know what? Preservationists were the largest group to be on the forefront of restoring this city. They're not given enough credit. The evidence is spread all around, so it's not in one particular place. But you go from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood, and you will see the preservationists were on the forefront. Several groups and many individuals. So it's very important. This is a very important message for cities all over this country that are so busy tearing down historic neighborhoods in the false idea that they need to shrink in order to accommodate current patterns. Shrinking doesn't work. It only makes it shrinking. You shrink a little bit here and a little bit there, and you keep shrinking. There's no growth in that shrinking, and especially when historic housing is what is the most desirable and the first to be bought up in any turnaround growth. So you have a hospital that a million square feet, built in the 1930s, an Art Deco gem, and there was, to put it mildly, there was an alternative proposal that would have updated Charity Hospital into a state-of-the-art hospital. It would have cost half the money and taken half the time of what has taken 10 years and counting, because it's not fully opened, and over $1.1 billion. In the process, to build the new hospital and to bring along a relocation of the Veterans Administration Hospital, we're talking about two hospitals that were totally relocated into a neighborhood of a rebuilding neighborhood that was one of the first neighborhoods to start coming back after the storm. People were actually restoring houses, some of them with government money. And instead, about 250 homes were demolished, 50 businesses displaced. And this was an integrated, economically, racially integrated neighborhood. It's staggering to think of this, but I also have to say, this is one of those stories that's a cautionary tale for other American cities. This is right out of the Robert Moses era of urban renewal and clearance, in which we destroyed so much of the really valuable urban fabric that you need for a resilient city to reemerge. You know, football stadiums, casinos, shopping malls, all these places, they're not about the fabric of a city. The fabric of a city is in its neighborhoods. And when you take away those neighborhoods, you diminish the fabric one thread at a time. In this case, there was no need, and it was not flooded. Charity Hospital was flooded in the basement. It had some damage. An extraordinary group of volunteers, of army, doctors, citizens, cleaned out and restored that hospital for patient ready 3 weeks after Katrina. And then LSU and the state shut it down and sabotaged that cleanup in order to argue for increased money from FEMA to build the new hospital. It is shocking. It is also shocking that there was never a congressional investigation into this.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary.
You know, I think one of the things that happens, one of the dynamics is that people feel so overwhelmed. A community feels so overwhelmed by a natural disaster, and they assume in the chaos and the throes of all that, that the best decisions are being made, and they don't question them. For people to step forward and question, though, is extraordinary in those circumstances.
Absolutely. And in this case, it was a valiant but small group of people who made everything clear. And it was not properly covered in the press. It was not heard by civic leaders. And the to add insult to injury, the city council never voted. No elected body ever actually voted and weighed the pros and cons that this was a good project. They nibbled it. They closed the streets, or they approved a piece here and a piece there. What Robert Moses used to call segmentation. So you had an approval of different pieces, but no one is accountable. No one actually said, you know, I'm voting for this. It was decided by people that were not representing, I don't know who they were representing. They were representing themselves. LSU, which had managed the hospital for years, and the state, they wanted a new hospital. This was another one of those Katrina disaster opportunities. They would, and I quote the guy right in the front of this chapter, when the state treasurer walked through the hospital with the head of the hospital at the time, and he said, "But why don't you open it now, even temporarily? It was cleaner than it had been before the storm." Mm. And the guy said to him, "But then we'll never get a new hospital." And that's it. Simple as that.
In the time remaining, Roberta, I want to ask you about New Orleans today. Just some numbers. The city's population before Katrina, about 455,000, dropped to 209,000 a year later. And then now today, I have it at about 379,000. And recent poll, NPR, Kaiser Family Foundation poll, showing that blacks and whites have different perceptions about the progress in the city since Katrina.
Sure.
Whites are definitely more upbeat about that. The city's starting to see some gentrification, I guess. Would you talk about some of those things today, where we are today with in New Orleans?
Well, first of all, there are more people there than any of the experts ever predicted, which is just one more, you know, one more nail in the coffin of experts. But let's realize that they're not the same people. There are a lot more white people. The ratio of black to white is not as what it was, and rich to poor is not what it was. So the perception, and when we talk about black-white, we have to remember there's a strong black middle class in New Orleans. So some of them are enjoying the rebirth that is hitting certain areas, and but you're still dealing with a city where the $7.25 hourly wage is going to keep people poor. Period. End of story. Now, is it a resilient city for the tourist and the upper income areas, you bet. Are there crime? Is crime still a problem? It is a terrible problem. Are there issues of inequities? Absolutely. So in many ways, it may sound trite, but it is a tale of two cities. It depends on which city you're looking at. And there is a great perception on the part of people of modest and low income that the city is not resilient for them. They can't afford to rent, or they can't afford to even live in the houses they own because taxes are going up as values go up. So there is gentrification in a negative sense, which is the displacement negative. I make an important issue of gentrification in this book, and I hope people who read it see this as an issue that applies to every city. The gentrification issue is oversimplified. It's not a matter of people with money moving in. That's the good news. It's because you know, blighted neighborhoods need new blood, but it's the displacement issue, and it's the issue of the political will to help people stay in the neighborhoods that they either own or rent a house in. That's where the issue of gentrification should be concentrated.
How upbeat are you now about New Orleans? We have about a minute left, Roberta.
Oh, I wouldn't give it one or the other. I'd say there's a fighting spirit there, but there's a lot of the old ways coming back. I'm worried about the way the city council is doing some of its backroom dealings with new zoning ordinances and planning issues. It's really taking it right back out of the hands of local people. And so I'm really worried about that. On the other hand, there's a more engaged population, and on some level, you know, they're winning some fights and they're losing others.
I was going to ask you about
them. There's a lot at stake.
They're more engaged, or they're suffering fatigue at this point?
Well, they did suffer fatigue, and I'm sure it's still fatiguing, but it's not the kind of fatigue that came right after Katrina when they were actually rebuilding their homes. They're engaged. Some of them are tired, but, you know, they're kind of angry. When they thought things were going well and now things are turning around, they're angry at the city for focusing only on tourism and doing everything for the tourists and not enough for the neighborhoods. So, you know, they're making their voices heard. What the impact is varies.
Roberta Brandis Gratz has been our author for this hour of the show of Midday. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate this very much. And what an enlightening book it is, and infuriating and embarrassing it is as well. Thank you very much, Roberta.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Roberta Brandis Gratz previously served on New York City's Landmarks Preservation Commission and New York City's Sustainability Advisory Board with Jane Jacobs. She founded the Center for the Living City. And she splits her time between New York and New Orleans. This book is about New Orleans in the 10 years since Katrina. It's called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Built Their City, and Nation Books is the publisher. I hope you enjoyed the program. We'll come back for some more Midday tomorrow. Have a great afternoon, and we'll see you soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.